Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Burdick, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, November 12th. Now you have less than 2 weeks to find a turkey. Again, good luck with that. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about the latest annual employer benefits survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation that came out this past week. Many people, including me, consider the Kaiser survey the gold standard for employer benefit surveys because of its methodology and the longitudinal data that it provides. This is the 23rd year that Kaiser has done the survey. Specifically on today's show, we're going to talk about changes in health insurance premiums this year and changes in health insurance benefits this year. To tell us what those changes mean for payers, providers, and patients are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
Yesterday was Veterans Day. Like most Americans, I'm enormously grateful for the sacrifices our vets have made to preserve the American way of life. Beyond veterans, I also appreciate the millions of service volunteers who labor, often in obscurity, to care for loved ones and support health and social care services organizations. They deserve our recognition too.
Yeah, hats off to all. That's great. Julie, how about you?
Well, my daughter was born on Veterans Day, so we just celebrated her 13th birthday, and I now officially have two teenagers. So if you find me a little distracted, don't be surprised.
Yeah, I'll say hats off to you too. Holy smokes. Good
Holy
luck.
Smokes.
Yeah. All right. Now, before we talk about what the new Kaiser survey found, let's talk about your own premiums and benefits. Dave, have you enrolled in your health plan yet? And will you be paying more or less for your benefits next year?
We haven't done it yet, so I don't know about amounts, but I'm sure they'll be higher. And we expect to do it shortly, probably this weekend. I've had a root canal, and I equate the experience as, you know, optimizing benefit selections with imperfect information is an exercise in frustration. There just has to be a better way.
Ouch. Thanks, Dave. Julie, same thing. Have you enrolled in your health plan yet, and will you be paying more or less for your benefits next year?
Well, we're on a Q1 cycle, so we haven't done it yet, but I'll say that this year I was on a high deductible, and I swear you go through that deductible so quickly with a family of four. It is just insane.
Yeah. Well, we enrolled in our health plan last week, same health plan, same benefits, same provider network, but a 3% bump in monthly premiums. I guess it could be worse, as we'll talk about in a minute. We'll see. All right. This Kaiser employee benefits survey, according to the survey of about 1,700 public and private employers, the average annual health insurance premium for single coverage rose 4% this year to $7,739, and the average annual premium for family coverage also rose 4% to $22,221 this year. Employees paid about 27% of the premium for family coverage this year and about 17% of the premium for single coverage. That's roughly the same employee contribution to premiums as last year. Dave, what's the story here? Is this good news or bad news for employers? Is this good news or bad news for employees?
On a relative basis, it's not either good or bad news for employers or employees. From an economic perspective, the headline would read more of the same for the 155 million Americans covered by commercial health insurance policies. I focus on the cost of family insurance policies. And as you mentioned, Dave, their average cost was up 4% to roughly $22,200. Their share of the premium remained the same, 27% or roughly $6,000. And the average deductible remained about the same too, $1,650. Wages were up 5%, so health insurance premiums going up 4% on average haven't added financial burden to workers. But inflation was just under 2%. So once again, commercial healthcare is growing at a greater rate than the overall economy. That's an old story, but not a good trend line. Benefit design also has not changed materially over the last decade, and certainly not in the last year for most employer-sponsored plans. given all the disruption caused by COVID, it's perhaps surprising that the commercial health insurance market hasn't changed more than it has. But of course, the devil's in the details. I'll focus quickly on three areas: the macro relationship between payers and providers, the deductible burden for those in commercial plans, and affordability. In 2020, payers had record profits and providers needed a government bailout. In 2021, payers have continued to prosper while providers have continued to struggle. I had conversations with two large system CEOs last week, and they're both expecting very acrimonious rate negotiations as they try to balance the payment flows between their costs and what they get paid. That means using all their market leverage to push for higher treatment rates. That's understandable, but doesn't create value and will add to overall healthcare inflation. On deductibles, they've been steady for 3 years, but that steadiness masks the larger trend that they're up almost 70% over the last 10 years. Workers with deductibles have increased from 74% of the workforce to 85% of the workforce during that same 10-year period. 30% of workers have annual deductibles greater than $2,000 as the number of high deductible health plans have increased. What this means to the healthcare marketplace is that consumers are becoming payers to a greater extent than they've ever been before, and they're starting to pay more attention to their healthcare purchases. So I think it's going to get harder for providers to charge premium prices for routine procedures like MRIs and colonoscopies when consumers can plan around those types of events. And then finally, several years ago, Zeke Emanuel and I created the Affordability Index that compared the relationship between the cost of a family health insurance policy and median household income. It's not a perfect measure, but does show the relationship between health insurance costs and income over time. In 2020, the median household income actually fell by over $2,000 from $69,560 to $67,521. Meanwhile, the cost of a family health insurance policy continues to rise, and the affordability index is at an all-time high of 33%. That compares to 14% when Kaiser first began publishing data on the costs of health plans in 1999. Moreover, there's wide variation in affordability indices across the states, with residents in lower income states on average carrying a greater payment burden for their health insurance. So without major structural change, and we're certainly not seeing it this year, health insurance provision will continue to crush average American families. So more of the same, Dave.
Yeah, we're losing ground. Thanks, Dave. Julie, what's your interpretation of the premium numbers? As Dave said, seems like business as usual, but is business as usual what we should be after?
Well, I definitely don't think we should be after business as usual, especially after the past couple of years we've had, and I think where we're headed. My headline for all this is why these increases are happening in these few year periods with what's happening with costs on the ground is a little perplexing to me, but I agree with everything Dave just said. But when you look at what's happening now with staffing issues in hospitals and at providers, we're going to see costs rise in a really material way, such that some of these cost hikes will be justified the next few years, which is just going to make this whole situation, you know, potentially even worse and look more dramatic in the next few years. That's my prediction. I was interested in, well, first of all, Dave, everything you said is so spot on, but it's kind of shocking when you see that the average deductible is up 68% over the past decade. Like, it's just, those are big percentages, right? No, it's a small number. I get it. But consumers are feeling it. That's for sure. I was interested to see that 86% of companies said that it's a key priority over the next couple of years to achieve affordable costs for their workers. And it seems like the pain points are especially at the bottom of the wage scale. So this is kind of the same old from employers always saying that, but there's never quite a lot of activity going on there. It looks like more employers are tying premiums to pay so that those lower income brackets have smaller monthly tabs. It makes sense from an overall cost perspective, but doesn't make logical sense in terms of where some of those costs lie in a particular population. So, you know, the strategies we're taking aren't always logical here. I read that nearly a third of companies are planning to offer narrow network products. And then fewer employers are discussing strategies around high deductible plans than they have in the past. And this is mostly because these plans aren't necessarily that effective for the low wage earners. So we're seeing some different trends, and certainly we were 5 years ago. What I also was struck by was that employers have some faith in these price transparency rules that have come out to actually have an impact on costs. So we'll see whether those employers are right. Overall, though, it's disappointing.
Got it. Thank you. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
Well, Julie's exactly right that the benefit design seems to be mostly focused on financial considerations, not overall health outcomes or health status. Nathan Bays and I co-wrote an article 5 years ago titled November Indigestion, the Idiocy and Promise of Benefit Selection. Guess where I was going with that one. Anyway, rereading that article, what meant reliving a nightmare. My wife and I are covered by her health insurance from the University of Chicago. And 5 years ago, UChicago incentivized Terry and its other employees to switch to high deductible health plans. So she and I spent the better part of a weekend trying to optimize our choices around at least a dozen factors: premiums, deductibles, copays, out-of-pocket maximums, drug costs, flex accounts, health savings accounts. I mean, the list just went on and on. What it reminded me of, that exercise, was doing option math when I was an investment banker, you know, calculating break-even and strike prices. You know, and that's the point. This exercise is a financial, not a human endeavor. And there were no optimal solutions because there were too many unknowns. So is it any surprise that health insurance companies have customer satisfaction scores on a par with cable company operators? So there's an enormous opportunity to make purchasing health insurance more understandable, convenient, efficient, personalized, and compassionate. And there are many innovative companies like Collective Health and Oscar that are working to make that purchasing of health insurance simple, transparent, and enriching. But boy, are we a long way from that nirvana.
Right. Yeah, very complex situation, and health literacy is definitely an issue. Thanks, Dave. Now let's talk about some of the benefits changes that employers made this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here are a few of the survey findings. 35% of employers who offered biometric screenings to workers made those screenings easier to get because of COVID. 39% of employers who offered health benefits to workers expanded workers' mental health benefits because of COVID. 55% of employers who offered wellness programs to workers made those programs easier to access because of COVID. And 65% of employers who offered telemedicine benefits to workers expanded those benefits because of COVID. Julie, on a previous episode of the Roundup, we asked whether employers are giving employees the benefits they needed because of the pandemic. This survey suggests that many of them are. Do you agree? And are these temporary changes, or do you see them sticking beyond the end of the pandemic?
Well, I have kind of two separate ways of thinking about this right now. One is things like the telemedicine benefits. There are so many virtual solutions who have sold into employers. And we're almost at the place now where I think it's the employer's responsibility to really think about how they get their employees engaged in some of these solutions that they purchase, not just check the box in an EAP way, but really drive engagement. You see companies like Accolade who work with employers on how to really incentivize employees to drive engagement. They should stick because they ultimately should be lower cost. And I think we're going to either need to see that or we're going to revert right back to where we were. On the mental health side, I'll take a different approach, which is I'm looking at some work recently by some folks at McKinsey who looked at what's really keeping employees today, or frankly, actually really what's driving employees away in the big quit or the great resignation, all these phrases we're using. And, you know, they talk about, I think, the connection between mental health and what people are really looking for. People are not necessarily really looking for higher pay and better benefit packages. So I wonder if employers are really either between a rock and a hard place with these benefits and just signing up for whatever they need to, or they're just really not thinking hard, because McKinsey found that employees really want to be valued by their organization and their manager and feel belonging with their team and their organization and be part of high-performing, trusting, open, caring teams and like the people they work with, all these things that we're hearing about as it relates to the job situation out there. People want more advancement. They want to understand that they can have the flexibility and the autonomy to actually get their work done and still advance in their career. So I would just encourage us to look at some of those inputs that are coming out societally, match those with what we're seeing on the health benefit side, and ask ourselves, like, what are we doing around really engaging people so that this mental health doesn't sit out there as something separate, that we're really thinking about bringing people into our community at work.
Right. Salaries and benefits are just part of the solution. That's great. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what's your read on these benefits changes because of the pandemic? Are we seeing a fundamental change in the health insurance benefits market? And if we are, who wins and who loses?
Well, I've been a bit of a Davy Downer the last couple of weeks, so it's nice to be able to finally talk about something I'm excited about. I think these are great trends and reinforce the need, as Julie was describing, for health insurance provision to be more accessible and holistic. Like Julie, I'm particularly encouraged to see the greater emphasis on mental health services. Separating mental and physical health the way the American healthcare system does is just crazy. It's like having car mechanics that only fix engines and not brakes. You know, you need both to have the car run. I happen to be in Minneapolis this week for the HFMA's annual national conference and got to listen to Dr. David Shulkin give a terrific keynote address on his efforts while he was the administrator of the Veterans Administration to improve care for vets. And they took major steps during his tenure to integrate mental health and social services into the care they provide. For example, removing silos through a single approach to care, no mental health referrals. Vets receive mental health consults on site. It's all part of one visit. Prioritizing suicide prevention by being proactive in identifying vets at risk and taking proactive steps to connect and address their personal issues. Cut the suicide rate in half. Launching the VA's whole health care model that includes self-care and team-based care. You know, caregivers have to take care of themselves as well. Also emphasizing at-home caregivers and peer support and how important they are in the overall health of our veterans. Cut homelessness in half, still way too large, but at least the trend going in the right direction. And dramatically increasing access in part by enabling PAs and pharmacists to practice at the top of their license. There's no better way to honor our veterans than by effectively addressing their health and social care needs. And I think the Veterans Administration is doing a better and better job of that. And it does feel, like Julie was describing, as if mainstream medicine is beginning to get that message, or at least employers are beginning to get that message and realize that if they want to keep their employees not only on the job, but highly productive, they're going to need to address the whole panoply of issues, including mental health issues. So I'm encouraged.
The future is whole person care. Thanks, Dave. Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
You know, I would just add that when you see theoretically front runner employer thinkers like JP Morgan with Morgan Health investing in Bera, which is a purpose built, you know, value driven care company, or you see other companies, like there's a ton of the now hybrid care companies, like mental health companies, addiction companies that are targeting employers to set up geographically convenient locations specific to that employer. Employers have such an opportunity today to really think about how to support everyone who's working for them in a different way, again, in a way that could drive costs down. So I'm excited about the innovation happening, that's for sure.
Yeah, smart employers will take advantage of this. Thanks, Julie. Well, with expanded benefits usually comes higher premiums, so it'll be interesting to see what happens to premiums when Kaiser does this survey again next year. We'll see.
Up, up, and away, just like the fifth dimension.
Right. Always a song reference, Dave.
I know, I hadn't done one yet. I had to get in there.
We were close. Yeah, just under the wire. All right, now let's talk briefly about other big healthcare news this past week. Julie, what other story made you stand up and take notice and why?
You know, I don't know if you saw Forrester predictions for 2022, which first of all, I was so excited to see someone talking about 2022 this early in 2021. But I was struck by a couple things. that they pointed out, one of their predictions was that labor shortages will double the medication error rate among providers. Ooh. And I think we're starting to see some pretty interesting connections between staffing and actual outcome and, you know, error situations that, you know, will have a big impact on how providers perform in 2022.
Interesting. We talked about infection rates going up a while back, so maybe they're onto something there. Thank you. Dave, what other healthcare news was above the fold this week for you?
We're back to talking about COVID. Disease rates are on the rise in about half of the states. David Leonhardt had this insightful analysis in the New York Times on death rates from COVID in 2020. Death rates in red counties, those that voted 60% plus for Trump, and blue counties, those that voted 60 plus for Biden, were roughly equivalent. But with the introduction of the vaccines, the death rates in red counties are now more than three times that of the blue counties. That's the vaccine effect, and its politicization is really driving the continuation of disease, continuation of the pandemic and its morbidity. It's almost like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. You know, we keep trying to get past COVID, but it keeps dragging us back in.
Well, I got my booster Tuesday.
Nice work.
So we'll see. Have you guys got your boosters yet?
I'm going Monday.
I have.
All right. We're doing our part. Thank you. For me, the other big story was this TransUnion healthcare report that said 35% of people with unpaid medical bills didn't seek care over the past year because they didn't want to add to that debt. It reinforces the healthcare affordability crisis that we have in this country, which gets back to what you were talking about, Dave, with your affordability index, an ongoing saga there. Well, thank you, Dave, and thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment for the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.